Sabria Ten Birkin is an incredible lady. Blind from the age of 12, her imagination and drive have led her on an incredible journey to push for social change. Together with her boyfriend and life partner Paul Cronenberg, they have spent the last 20 years empowering some of the most marginalised people in society, and I'm delighted to introduce you to them now. Hello, guys.
Hello. Hi.
So, Sabria, can you just take us back to your childhood, please, and where this journey began?
I think I should begin at the point when I realised that I would become blind. I would always say that was around the age of 9. And I still remember that I was standing at a side of a frozen lake, and I was wondering why the people were going on ice skate in circles. Mm. And what I didn't see was the hole in the middle. So when I jumped on the ice with my ice skates and I went right through the circle, I felt it very clearly what was happening there. And I understood that I couldn't trust my eyes anymore. And from that point onwards, it actually went down. So that was a very, very tough time for me, I must say, because I didn't want to accept that I would become blind eventually.
I read somewhere, Sabria, that one of the things you were most scared of was darkness. And that never arrived, did it?
Yeah, this is an interesting thing. And a lot of sighted people believe, or made me believe, that blindness, complete blindness, is darkness. And I was scared of darkness. I really must say, I tried it out and I was not very happy going through the basement and stumbling over a lot of things. I was also scared of discrimination. I was scared of being sidelined. But what scared me most was not being able to see my world surrounding me anymore, you know, and be somewhere. I felt that blindness must be claustrophobic. And later, when I did understand that actually blindness has a lot to do with imagination, or it had a lot of advantages to it, then I said, okay, now I can become blind. I don't mind anymore, and darkness can come, because if I have my imagination, then yeah, I can face the world again. And then something very interesting happened. I went to an ophthalmologist, and I thought I still see quite a lot. And the ophthalmologist told me that I was completely blind, that I could not even see light and dark anymore. And I never realized that. And I actually thought my world surrounding me became much, much more colorful, and that it's still like that. So I do feel that I see whatever I want to see. It's like reading a book.
Sure. Is that what blindsight is, Sabria?
I think this is blindsight. It could be blindsight. I'm not so sure exactly what blindsight means, but I have heard from many other blind people who have the same feelings about blindness, and it could be that that the visual cortex is still so active that everything that we imagine, or everything that we hear and feel and smell, automatically turns into visual images. And I can imagine that this is called blindsight. I'm not so sure about it.
Now, did you carry on in mainstream education from the age of 12?
No, I left happily. I left the school. And because I was pretty much discriminated by my schoolmates, and I couldn't stand that anymore. And once I really understood that this is my life now, and I accepted being blind, I decided myself to go to a school for the blind. And that was a really, really good school. It's in Marburg. It's called Blister.
This is in Germany.
It's in Germany, yeah. It's close to Frankfurt. And what I really liked about the school, first of all, I learned Braille, I learned mobility training, walking with a white cane, also accepting the fact that I'm blind, using my audio skills to find my way around, to orientate myself. But then also what I really liked about the school was there was an amazing focus on sports. And not just regular sports, but really adventurous sports. So, for example, kayaking, white water kayaking, downhill skiing, riding, not only just riding, but also acrobatics on horse. We had trampoline. We had all kinds of trekking and mountaineering and windsurfing and all that, what sighted people think is might be dangerous. And our teachers, they understood, hey, you just need to learn the techniques and then the world is open for you. And this is something that I really appreciated about this school. And it's a very academic school, so they really expected something. Normally, the world is suffering from the problem that there's always low expectations for blind people. So if blind people get a regular school education, it's fine. But this school is very, very much focused on a very high education. So we had to learn a lot of languages. We had to have a good science foundation, a very, very good mathematics foundation. People are studying mathematics, studying informatics or programming, studying even sciences, which I don't see so many times in other schools.
So from there, you went straight to university?
Yes, from there, I went to university. I decided to study Tibetology. And also, again, our teachers in my school, they were actually very happy when I came up with this idea to study Tibetology. I mean, we could not be crazy enough for them, you know? So they were a bit bored of people studying just law and psychology, yeah. And which are good professions. But they said, well, is there anyone who can study something else? You know, they wanted to have, how to say, trailblazers in the school. And sure. They were quite happy to prepare me for Tibetology. And I decided to study Tibetology because I wanted to get out of Germany. I wanted to have an adventurous life. And this they felt I need to have. So there was no thing like you cannot. There was always, if you really want to do this, you will be able to.
So it was around this time, Sabria, that you followed your sense of adventure and headed to Tibet.
In 1997, spring 1997, I travelled. And I travelled with my Braille script, which I had developed in university for my own use, actually.
Sure.
It's a Tibetan Braille script, which is based on the syllable script. And it worked very well for me. So I thought, if it works for me and I can translate it into a digital form, why not showing it to the blind in Tibet as well? So I traveled to show it to the blind, but also to collect some stuff for my master's, which I never did. You know, I never finished my studies, because then in Tibet, what happened was I found people, partners who would actually be able to do this together with me. Mm. And besides the Tibetan partners, I found Paul. And that was, of course, my biggest fortune.
Now, Paul, your life was obviously to change forever from that moment onwards as well, but can you describe the moment you first met Sabria?
Well, it was in 1997, it was in June, and I travelled to Tibet by myself, and one of the first people I met in Lhasa was Sabria. And when she told me her story, you know, that she wanted to start up this project, then I said, you know what, I'll join you, so give me a call when you're ready and we'll do this together. And then about 8.5 months later, she called me up. I was in Holland and at home working. And then the phone rang and it was Sabria telling me that in a week she would be leaving for Tibet. Uh-huh. And I said, you know what? So first of all, I didn't say anything because I was still thinking, what should I do next? And then she said, well, we don't know each other that well. At least you can wish me luck. Don't cry or anything. And I said, you know what? I'll join you. So the next day I quit my job. And 5 days later, we went back together to Tibet.
Why were you in Tibet in the first place, Paul? Were you working there?
No, I had two reasons to go. One is when we work with our participants here in Kerala as well, we're talking about a pinching point, you know, what motivates people to do something. And for Sabria, it was very clear that the discrimination, the injustice that's done towards blind people was bothering her, and she could see a way to help, you know, blind kids in Tibet or to fight for the rights with them together. And for me, I had, when I was about 11 years old, I went to the doctor and I had red spots on my back, and the doctor was asking, what is that? And I said, well, who's the doctor here? Mm-hmm. So he didn't know what it was, and he gave me some medicine, and he said, in a week, everything will be gone. All the red spots will be gone. And he was right. My red spots were gone, but my skin was gone also. So for about 6 years, I had no skin on my back. So this meant that, you know, the T-shirts get stuck, and I had to wear dark T-shirts to cover it up, basically. And of course, my students, my peers, they found out about it and they slap you on the back and they don't want to pick you for the football team. They don't want, you know, they kind of put you on the sidelines. So, yeah, and I know what it means to be sidelined. Later on, I was in Africa and I saw, you know, a lot of misery and people die in Zimbabwe and, you know, women and children, no arms, no legs because of landmines in Mozambique. And so for me, it was very clear I want to do something that has meaning in life and where it's not just about me, but about others as well. And so meeting Sabria was absolutely great. It happened in the right time, so it was great for me to join her.
Now, Sabria, when you first arrived in the country, you actually trekked across Tibet on horseback, trying to change attitudes towards blindness.
Yeah, I didn't really try to change attitudes. I tried to find blind children in the first place, and I wanted to see how blindness is viewed in the Tibetan culture. And what I saw there was actually quite sad, because, a lot of people, they didn't know what to do with blind people. We saw blind people being locked away. Later also, we had many, many blind people who were basically tied to a chair. So they grew up in the position of the chair, even they could not walk properly. Then I saw a little, I thought it was an infant, and later I found out it was a 5 years old that looked like an infant. And she was always on a bed and tied to a bed and couldn't walk and couldn't talk because nobody would talk to her. And it's not because they wanted to harm, but it's mainly because they felt that blindness is useless.
And they also wanted to protect the children in a roundabout way.
Definitely. Protection is one thing. But then also there's a superstitious beliefs about blindness. Not everybody, but a few people feel that blindness is a punishment for something that you have done in your past life. So we had kids who were telling us that they were murderers before in their last life, you know. And some kids even, they said, well, if we were murderers before, how come that we are having such a nice life this year, you know, or this life? So this whole punishment thing is something that I found in Tibet, but also, I must say, in India. So karma is the key word here. So that people feel that they are disabled because of bad karma they have collected in their past life.
Now, this, of course, was the catalyst for what would eventually become Braille Without Borders.
We were understanding that it needed a change from within. It needed a change from the kids themselves. I could not go there as a long nose or as a white person into the rural areas to tell the people that they should change the attitude towards the blind. It doesn't really work like that, because they would always say, well, you are coming from a different country. What do you know? I met a little boy, Tenzin, and Tenzin was very, very confident. He was actually the only blind person I met who was very confident. And he told me that he had a little job. When he was 7 or 8 years old, he wanted to go to school, and the school teacher, the principal, didn't want him. And the people, not the school principal, but the village chief, he gave him the task to herd the yaks in the mountains. Now, for a village kid in Tibet, this is a very, very important task, because yaks means wealth. And he had to herd a big group of yaks, and he knew exactly which ones were his and which ones belonged to another village because of the belts. And he showed us how he would orientate himself. Actually, he taught himself mobility training with a branch that he took from a willow tree.
Okay.
And but he used it for everything, you know. He used it to touch the path in front of him, but also to jump over the creeks and ditches and to hit the yaks on the backs if they would not move fast enough, and all these kind of things. So, and this kid was, and still is, I mean, now he's an adult, very, very confident and very assured of himself and what he can do and what he cannot do. And from that point onwards, I understood that the change has to come from these kids. We have to empower them in such a way that they jump back into society. Why putting them in a school which is basically out of the society or out of reach of the society, but rather giving them a springboard where they are so empowered to jump back into society and say, hey, yes, I'm blind. What does it matter? You know, so what? I can do many, many things that sighted people can also do. And this exactly worked out. So we started Braille Without Borders with a little preparatory school. Later it became bigger, but we never reached to a very big size because we always wanted to have them only for a short period of time, 2 or 3 years, and that's it. And then they have to go out and have to integrate themselves into regular schools.
Paul, can you talk about some of the success stories, please?
Well, I think what is most important is that these kids understand that they've got value. And because they have that, then they get dignity and then they can develop self-confidence. So most of the students, when they came in, like Sabri mentioned as well, some of them, they came directly from a dark room, and they were never asked what they wanted to do in life or how they are. And suddenly now they had a chance to gain all these skills and gain the self-confidence so that they were prepared to, you know, go back to regular schools.
Sure.
When we had this after a couple of years, when our students were ready, they learned Tibetan Braille, they learned Chinese, English, they learned mathematics skills, daily living skills, basically everything they needed to proactively integrate themselves into a regular school system. When we wanted to start this, the government, you know, our governmental partner, they were not so, you know, convinced, and they said, well, the society is not ready for this. And we said, well, our kids are. So we found a way to have four students going into a regular school for this self-integration program that we started. And this was about 90 kilometers outside of the city. And we asked the headmaster to, you know, give it a try. And after 1 week, he called us up, and we thought, oh, God, he's going to ask us to take them back. And he said, well, can you send more? The good thing was our students were very, very motivated, and they learned. They're very smart, and they got a lot of self-confidence, and they were very well prepared to go to this regular class. And they would tell to their neighbor, well, you tell me what's on the blackboard and I'll make your English homework or help you with your English homework later on. And so there was this trade-off, and this worked very well. And of course, the sighted kids, they didn't want to be beaten by the blind kids. So the level basically of the entire class went up after our kids integrated, you know, and that's a good thing.
Now, Paul, these children have basically gone from being pariahs in the local villages to being the most educated in the villages. It's a complete turnaround, isn't it?
Yes, the change of the students that we see, you know, when they come in and once they leave is very, very big. And one reason for that is that when these students came, at first, they were like, some of them, they came directly from a dark room. And there was no confidence, nothing. And so we said, what can we do to give these children hope for the future? You know, everyone has to get up for some reason in the morning. And so we started the Dream Factory. And we believe that dreaming is one of the most important things in life. Everything that we have today started with the dream of someone, right? So we asked our students to answer the most important question in life, and that is, what do I want? Not what my parents want me to do, or, you know, your grandfather, your grandmother, your sisters, brothers, the society. What is it that you want to do? And we gave them 1 week time to think about this, because if you do something that you love doing, you never have to work a day in your life, because sure, you love what you're doing, right? Yeah. So if I have to becomes I want to, that's where the magic happens, we always say. So we started this Dream Factory, and we asked these our students what it is that they really, really wanted to do. And we gave them 1 week time to think about this, and after 1 week, there was Norbu, 8 years old. He had a smile on his face, and he said, well, I want to become a taxi driver. So, of course, we could have said, well, that's very stupid, you're blind, and it's not going to be possible. Mm. But we don't have the right to destroy anyone's dream. So we said, wonderful. So 2 years after that, we had another Dream Factory with new students that came in, and Norbu was there, and we asked him, Norbu, what about the status of your dream? And he said, well, you know, the fact is that I understood that maybe becoming a taxi driver is a little bit overambitious and not so safe. But instead of not becoming a taxi driver, I could set up a taxi company and run it. And, well, that's a much better solution, isn't it?
It's a fantastic solution.
And for Nobu, it was great that he understood, you know, what it is that he wanted to do. And then, of course, that brings a lot of motivation. And we always say it's much easier to educate motivated kids than it is to motivate educated kids. So anything, if somebody's motivated, they can learn anything.
Now, as the school started to gain attention throughout the world, you had the once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, along with the children, to climb Mount Everest in what would become the film Blindside. How did that come about, Sabria?
Blindside was made in 2004, so it's a long time ago. Actually, I remember I was writing to Eric Weinmeier, the blind mountaineer who first climbed Everest.
Sure.
When he did it and he could do it, I talked to the kids about it, and they hardly believed it at first. But then they were, of course, fascinated, because Everest is part of their home as well, you know,
sure,
and some people come from Everest region. Now, I wrote to Eric and I said, well, next time when you're in Tibet, why don't you come by and talk to the kids? And Eric made a big thing out of it. So he didn't come alone. He came with a whole film team. And then it became another big, big adventure. which was a little bit, at first, it went a little bit over our head because we are not mountaineers. We are not really, well, we love adventure, but it needs to be purposeful. Now, we feel it was purposeful in the end. It became purposeful because the kids, they really understood a lot about togetherness in a challenging environment. And they understood how to adapt to their own personal environment. As I said, a lot of these kids, they come from very rural areas where they have icy roads and stones and no paths whatsoever. And they learned through the techniques that Eric was bringing to them, they learned pretty much how to walk in these very, very difficult areas. And they became much, much more confident in not only in being in a city or being in a village environment, but really being in a rural environment. So that was good. Now, whether we had to go up there or not, that's a big question mark.
And you actually climbed 23,000 feet of the north side of Everest as well. That is incredible.
Yes, it was high and very little oxygen. Lot of people, it was very, very cold. A lot of people became sick. And the interesting thing about a mountain, the mountain doesn't choose whether somebody is blind or not, you know. So blind people got sick and non-blind people got sick. Blind guys, they were very fit, and I was rather fit, but many others also, even from the mountaineers, they were not feeling so well. So therefore, in the mountains, it doesn't really matter whether you are very fit or not.
What was the feeling like among the group when you all reached the highest point, the 23,000 feet? Was it exhilarating?
Well, it was, no, it was not exhilarating, it was tiresome, it was it was just so cold that I couldn't feel my feet for many, many days. You have headache, you have no air to breathe, you have a lot of big problems that you would not have on lower level. No appetite whatsoever. And the only thing that you are thinking of is going down as fast as possible.
Now, Paul, am I correct in saying that altitude in the Himalayas has a lot to do with blindness in the region?
It's correct. There's a lot of cataract because of the high UV light radiation at altitude. So if you look at Tibet, it's mostly above 3,600 meters where people live. So between that and 5,000 meters. So it's very, very high UV light radiation. Another big cause is that they heat their huts and their houses with yak dung.
Okay.
And dried yak dung. And because of the altitude, there's less oxygen, so the burning process is not very... So there's a lot of soot. Mm-hmm. And the soot gets on the cornea, and people wipe with their dirty hands, and they get infections, and that causes also blindness. And there's a lot of inherited blindness as well.
So as the project in Tibet was going from strength to strength, only a few years later, you started looking at how you could branch out. And that was to take you to India, where you would do things slightly differently.
There was one article in the New York Times, or one journalist who came from the New York Times, and he asked us, so what is going to happen after Tibet? And yes, we thought about this. And what we felt is we understood it is possible to take people from the margins and empower them so much that they can basically change the society. In the very beginning when we came, blind people were seen as fools, as stupid, as non-educated. And in a very relatively short period of time, the inhabitants of Lhasa actually were defending the blind when they were teased by nomads who came into Lhasa. They were saying, hey, wait a minute, they can speak English. Can you speak English?
Yeah.
And our kids, of course, they were confident enough to defend themselves. Also, what we saw is that these kids, they were really going for their dreams. Some of these kids went through the regular school in no time. They jumped over classes. They had great education. They are now in universities. Others, they started their businesses. And we always thought to ourselves, why? And a lot of other people asked us, and we couldn't really answer the question at first, why are these kids so successful in a region where blindness is so marginalized, or where blind people are so marginalized? And yes, and then when we thought about it, we thought, well, there are actually a few factors which lead to this momentum that the blind kids become so successful. One thing is definitely these kids have nothing to lose. They are so much out in the margins of society that whatever they do, it's a plus. Whatever they achieve, it's a plus. They can risk something, which is really, really good, because nobody is expecting anything. So they can try out things. The other thing is, of course, they don't feel that they have to be everybody's darling. Now, when you look in Europe, everybody is taught and raised with this understanding you have to be a good girl and a good boy. But good girls and good boys, we all know, they never change the world, you know? And these kids, they were never really part of the society, never really accepted by society. So they could stand up for their own viewpoints. This is one very, very important thing. So to do something, to stand up for something, you have to have the feeling that you don't have to be everybody's darling. They were taught ethics. They were taught to be punctual, for example, also not to have excuses. Now, being punctual in Tibet, it's actually something very good, because nobody is punctual. Nobody's on time. Only the Chinese are very much on time. The Han Chinese are very much on time, and they always get the jobs. But the Tibetans, they take it a bit more relaxed with the time. And when our kids now are on time and can deal with deadlines, especially in their adult life, it is a huge advantage for them. And especially also not keeping wrong promises or not making up excuses. Another thing is that they are really going for their dreams. This is something they have learned in our dream factory that Paul just explained. Yes. To create dreams, to go for these dreams, to believe in these dreams. And they understand that blindness doesn't have to be a limitation, that blindness does not have to be a disability, but it can be a possibility. By understanding that blindness is problem solving or means problem solving, it means focus. You are not distracted by Hollywood and Bollywood. It means that you have to speak clearly, that you have to make yourself clear by good pronunciation and good communication. And blindness means imagination. So they understood that actually, if we embrace blindness, not just accept it, but embrace it as something positive, that we are getting much, much further. Now, when we understood this, we thought to ourselves, why not training, empowering people from all kinds of margins of society to do exactly the change that our blind kids are doing? Because a lot of these kids, I'm talking about kids, they are adults now, you know, but sure. A lot of them, they're running their own social ventures or businesses. They're going to universities. They're doing really, really well, also exceptionally well in comparison to many, many others. Now, why not using this advantage of being marginalized, not looking at it as a disadvantage, but using it as an advantage, and making sure that we train or empower people who have overcome adversity in their life and who have a dream for social change? Why not empowering them to actually start and run their own social ventures? Because we believe development work, as it has been done so far, is always that people who are not affected by social ill are going into the countries and tell the people who are affected what to do different in life.
That seems a little patronizing, Sabria.
Exactly. It's a top-down approach. And we believe that people who are in the problem, who have gone through the problem, they will much, much better find solutions that are sustainable. Can I give you one example?
Of course, please do.
So one thing that happened to me all the time, especially when I was just starting to become mobile and using my white cane, very often I stood at the side of the street and was just listening to the traffic, or I was waiting for a friend. And then what happens to me and to many, many others, there's suddenly a hand coming out of nothing and pushes me over the street. And just in the middle of the street, I start to become rebellious and say, hey, wait a minute, I didn't want to go on the other side of the street. Mm-hmm. And then very often what happens is that the hand is getting loose and the person is running away, you know, maybe angry because I was so ungrateful. And that's exactly what we are doing as development organizations coming from Europe, going to Africa, for example, or to India, mm-hmm. and telling the people, pushing the people over the streets without actually asking them whether they want to be there, and without empowering them to maybe go themselves if they really want to go themselves. So we are empowering them to decide themselves.
Paul, can you just talk about that transition period then, please, and how it all came into effect?
So once our project in Tibet were running very well, we thought, okay, what could be next? Because at some point we probably can't stay in Tibet. That was going to be very clear. And also it was not our goal to, you know, to be in Tibet for the rest of our lives. We are there just to start, you know, to get some startup energy, and then our colleagues should take over. And we were looking at ways where could our staff, you know, our colleagues be trained. And when we looked worldwide, we couldn't find a place where practical, hands-on leadership skills are being taught. And at that point, we said, why not starting something ourselves? We got a lot of experience now of how not to do things. We made a lot of mistakes in the first years in Tibet, which cost a lot of time and a lot of, you know, frustration and a lot of energy loss. Mm. And so if we could, you know, create a training where we can prevent others who start our projects, be it for the blind or other social projects, from having to repeat the same mistakes we did, that of course would speed up the process. We then looked also in okay, where could we go and what could we do? So we first of all looked at, okay, where are we going? And we looked around the world and we actually said, let's go to the center of the world. And believe it or not, the center of the world is here in South India. And when people come here, they say, like, oh, you guys are crazy. Why is this the center of the world? Well, if you draw a circle, imaginary circle around Trivandrum in the south of India, and then you expand that circle, then at some point you will see that it includes Asia, mm-hmm. Eurasia, and Africa. And that's where most people on the planet live. So this is basically right in the center of the world. And it's if you look at India, it looks a little bit like a springboard. So we're at the tip of the springboard. And what we wanted to do is to create a leadership training center where participants come and they're going to be trained in many, many different skills. And they're going to know about what to do in certain emergency situations and, you know, how to, you know, maintain a project, because starting up a project is easy, but continuing it is much more difficult. And then they would use this springboard, you know, to jump back either back to Africa, back into India, Southeast Asia, wherever they came from. So it's going to be a training center where they come for a 7 months, very intense training, and then they return, and within 5 months they get some more support to start up their projects. That was the idea at that time. And that's how we ended up in the south of India. And the name we started with was International Institute for Social Entrepreneurs, and that was IISE. It was a terrible name if you look back at it, because social entrepreneurship is not really defined in unison. You know, if you look around the world, if you would ask somebody what is social entrepreneurship, then, you know, you get different explanations from everyone you ask. So one day we were very lucky, because Sabria was having lunch and suddenly she jumps up and she was jumping up and down, and she said, what the heck was that? And well, one of our colleagues, he just started smiling because Sabria just bit on a kandari. And a kandari is a small but incredibly powerful chili. It's one of the spiciest chilies in the world. So Sabria was literally on fire. She said, wow, that's something else. We have to learn more about what this kandari is. So we looked up and we found out that a kandari is this very, not only a very, very spicy chili, but it's a very healthy chili. It lowers your blood pressure, it purifies your blood, it makes you awake better than coffee can. There's a lot of positive qualities on this chili, and it's also used as a word for a child that doesn't accept the status quo. And, you know, and so we said, this is a perfect symbol for a social change maker. So that's how we adopted the name Kandari for not only the institute naming names as Kandari, but also the Kandari as a social change agent. And our vision or our hope is that within the next 5 or 10 years, that when people talk about Gandhi or Mandela or any other social change agent in this world, that they say Kandari Gandhi or Kandari Mandela. So that people know that if they talk about a Kandari, it's about a positive social change maker.
Can you also talk about some of the things the students have gone on to achieve in the respective countries after completing the course?
So there are people from very, very different or with very different topics and interest points. So, of course, we do have a lot of blind people who came, which is great. I love to be together with blind people who want to start a social change. So, for example, we have Srishti from Nepal, who is running Blind Rocks. And Blind Rocks is about dance and adventure and acting. She was a dancer before she became blind, or she's still a dancer. But of course, as people can imagine, when she found out that she was becoming blind, everybody told her she cannot be a dancer anymore. And then she came here and she said, what the heck? Of course I can become a dancer, you know, or I can be still a dancer, even if I'm blind. Mm-hmm. So she started a school, a mobile school all around the world, where she trains blind people in Bollywood dance and in acting skills, in expression skills, in body language, mm-hmm. and in adventure. So she's doing skydiving and white water rafting with them. Then we have, for example, Turn Trash into Treasure. This is a woman from Nigeria. She's not blind, she's sighted. And she has experienced domestic violence. And actually her mother told her when she was little, her mother told her, once you become educated and you have a good job, you will not be a victim of domestic violence. So she did get a good education, sure. and she got a good job. But then her first husband was beating her so hard that she woke up in the hospital. And then she walked through the slums of Lagos and she saw all the trash lying around and she understood that actually she felt like trash. And she looked at this trash from this perspective and she understood, how can I turn trash to treasure? How can I turn myself into treasure? And now she is having a really very, very successful project all over Nigeria, where she trains women who are suffering from domestic violence from all classes, from middle class and higher class and low class. She is training them how to turn trash into treasure, and she's making a huge difference because these women, they are standing up against their husbands and make sure that they are never ever beaten again. And so we have people with environmental backgrounds who are environmental protectors. We have people who come from the streets. We have people who have albinism and who are fighting against the right not to be murdered and slaughtered to death. Because people who have albinism in East Africa are actually endangered to be murdered by witch doctors, because politicians and business people, they would love to have an organ or a finger of an albino in their pocket to be more successful. And she's fighting against it. So we have people who are doing movements, campaigns, but all of them have the goal to make the world, it sounds like a cliche, but to make the world a little bit better, to make the society better, to create a real social change.
Now, you both have received numerous awards right around the world. I think I read somewhere that you're not particularly big on talking about awards. You see them more as a means to an end for all the good work that you're doing. But if I could just ask you to talk about a few of them, which ones mean the most?
Of course, it's nice that it's been recognised that people see what we're doing and they see the impact, and that helps to convince potential donors, supporters, to support our work. Every recognition that comes our way, we're very grateful for that, and we're not asking for it. You see, a lot of people, they apply for getting awards and getting recognition, but we haven't asked for any of them. So somehow, you know, people got a note of it, that what we're doing is going on, and of course we're very grateful, and hopefully it will help us to continue our work for the many years to come.
I do feel that the many awards that came from China actually mean quite a lot to us. I mean, not for us personally, but for the project that needs to go on, you know. So there is a danger right now that the project is going to be closed. Since we received so many awards in China, a lot of people are asking now, why should this project be closed down? It's running so well. It has so much success. It's known all over China. Blind people are running these projects themselves nowadays. We don't have to be there. And why should the government close it down? And that's, of course, a question that is asked. And for that, these many awards that we have received in China are quite useful, because they help us to question the decision that they might want to close this project down.
This is Lhasa, Tibet, you're talking about, yeah?
We were there last August and they told us to leave, which we expected to some extent because we knew that at one point we would be out of the country, and therefore we prepared and trained our successors, the blind themselves, to actually run this project. And they ran it with a lot of enthusiasm and with their own vision, actually. It became their own project, which is great. But the fact that they wanted to close it down, that was new to us, and that was not, absolutely not expected. Now, the farm has maybe a little bit more chance. There's a training farm with cheese factory, with animal husbandry, with bakery, with a compost factory, and all kinds of professions. That has maybe a bigger chance to survive because the city of Shigatse is behind it and they want to take the protection over it. The school in Lhasa might be closed for some really bad reasons. And I would like to talk about these reasons. Can I?
Of course.
Yes. So we do have the feeling that the Tibet Disabled Persons Federation has never really thought about what is empowerment of the disabled. Now, they received a lot of money from Beijing. And by the way, Beijing actually is in favor of our project. The Chinese Disabled Persons Federation, several times they came, they saw it, they said that's real empowerment, it's real integration, and they want to actually do similar projects elsewhere in China. But the Tibet Disabled Persons Federation, because a lot of people are not disabled who are in this department, they thought, oh no, the best thing is we are starting with the money that we've received from Beijing, we're starting a lot of homes for the disabled. So it's basically special schools without any special education, but just homes where all kinds of disabled children would put in. It's mainly outside of the city, wall around and out of sight. And that's exactly what we didn't want.
Sure.
We wanted to prepare them to jump back into society. And they are not interested in integration. For them, it's all too difficult, too complicated, too complex. And why should the blind, why should the deaf be integrated? It's not necessary, you know? So this is one point. Then, of course, they thought, hey, so we have these schools, five schools they built up, which are basically empty, almost empty, not completely, but almost empty. And they are huge. And they're a little bit impersonal. Now, how to fill these schools? Oh, we have some blind projects there with a lot of educated blind kids. That's easy. So why not taking these blind kids to fill up the schools? That's a very, very sad motive, I really must say. Another thing is building that we bought for the school. It's an old building, beautiful building right in the middle of the city. Back then, Lhasa was small and the building was not too expensive, so we could afford it. Now, Lhasa became very, very big, and the prices, the ground prices, the plot prices are skyrocketing. And a lot of people have the feeling, and business people have the feeling, that they probably think, hey, why not selling this plot and doing something else with the money? And that, again, is so sad, because with our building, the kids were right in the middle of the society, right 300 meters from the inner part of the city, Lhasa. And they are seen, and people understand that there are blind people in this world who are going very, very confidently with their white canes. That is another thing. And of course, they have the feeling, hey, come on, this is a project which is too Western and westernized, which has alternative educational methods. The kids are outspoken, they're too confident. And definitely something like that was in their minds as well. Now we are still fighting, and therefore your radio show definitely helps us also, next to many other media that is fighting for our cause. But we are still fighting also along with diplomats who are very, very much behind us and very much on our side. Talking to the government in Beijing. Actually, the government in Beijing says, well, we are interested in this project, but what can we do? It's Tibet. Now, the school is not closed yet, and we really, really hope that the people in Lhasa become enlightened and understand that they are closing down a precious piece, something that could be a role model for China, if not also for the world, in terms of self-integration and proactive integration.
All the more incredible when you think that the Chinese government actually voted you one of the 15 most influential foreigners of the last 30 years.
Yeah, we feel so too. I do feel that also in Europe, there are a lot of things that still need to be done. And if there's anyone who has overcome adversity in their lives and who has a plan for social change, in whatever direction, it could be in terms of media, it could be in terms of environment protection, it could be in terms of disability empowerment, education, alternative education, conflict management, and so on and so forth. If there's anyone who has a plan for social change, why don't you look up our website, www.kantari.org, Kantari with a K-A-N-T-H-A-R-I. And then, maybe you apply, maybe not for this year anymore, it's almost done, but for next year, definitely.
Sabria, can I ask you what you think about the Western world's attitude to blindness?
I have the feeling there's a lot of overprotection going on, a lot of low expectations. I see it in Germany, and I heard from our blind kids from Tibet who studied in England that they see it as well. So two of our blind students, they were studying in English, and they asked me once whether they could visit a school for the blind. And I was a bit hesitant, and I said, well, maybe you feel inferior because they have all this technology in the world and they are so computer savvy. And they didn't even wait for my answer. They just went. And what was quite interesting, so they went all by themselves, traveled from city to city. And what was quite interesting was that the kids from the blind schools, of course, they were amazed that two Tibetans are traveling, blind Tibetans are traveling all by themselves, just with a cane. And they said, yeah, well, but we have a mouth to ask around, and we have a brain to think, and we have a cane with us. And then it turned out that a lot of blind kids in these schools don't even use a cane because they don't want to feel obviously blind. Mm. They think that, if we are using a cane, then people might not take us seriously anymore and so on and so forth. And one even said, and maybe I don't get a girlfriend if they see that I'm blind. And then one of our former students, he said, well, you are blind, just face it, you know. And if you don't get a girlfriend just because she thinks it's not cool to have a blind boyfriend, well, then she doesn't deserve you. And to hear this from a blind guy from Tibet, I think, is quite enormous. Also, what he told us was that he talked to the teachers. He was, of course, amazed about the computer savviness. And he asked for Braille, whether there's also Braille literacy. And yes, there is, but the teachers were not so fond of Braille. And they said, well, it's old-fashioned and it's slow and it's not so, it's also not so cool anymore, you know, and computers are much faster. And then he became really angry and he said, well, I'm from a nomad family where nobody knows how to read and write. And speech synthesizers are great to read something quickly, but are not very useful if you want to read something deeply or understand something really, sentence by sentence. And he said, well, if you don't know Braille and you are just using speech synthesizers, I'm sorry to say, but then you are illiterate. And he told the teachers that they are basically producing children who become illiterate with this attitude. And again, hearing this from a blind person who comes from an almost illiterate society, I think it's quite enormous, you know, that he has to go to Europe to teach the teachers about literacy. So what tells me this is actually that there is no real acceptance of blindness, whether amongst the blind people themselves, of course, not with all, but with many. Mm-hmm. Many don't really embrace blindness as an advantage. They still measure themselves on the abilities of sighted people and don't focus on what they really can do. And maybe when they would focus on what they can do really, maybe they would come to the point where they understand that blindness can be a possibility and doesn't have to be a limitation. And this is something that I always tell the people when I'm in Europe, look, what is disability? Disability is, first of all, it's very individual whether you see blindness as a disability or not. And it depends on the situation. If I want to be a bus driver and this is my biggest dream, then yes, I'm 100% disabled and I'm 100% useless because there is no bus yet that drives by itself. But if I want to start and run, for example, a leadership training center for social change, blindness might be a big advantage and a big privilege, actually, because I'm credible and I can relate to any kind of marginalization. And this, of course, is something that the blind people in Europe, in Germany, in England, I must say, unfortunately, also in India, still need to learn, in my opinion.
And Sabria, you're a firm believer that we're all disabled at the end of the day anyway, aren't you?
Yes. A lot of times I ask the people what is actually disability, and I give them this picture of walking at a beach, and you walk nicely on the sand, and next to you is the blue ocean, and on the left side are the palm trees, and then above you is an eagle. And the eagle looks at you. And what does the eagle think? If he can't think properly and he can't judge you, how would he judge me as a human being? Probably as a creature that is pretty useless. I mean, we cannot fly. We have arms which are pretty useless. We have legs which are actually also pretty useless, because how fast can we really run compared to a tiger or to a panther? Our eyes are pretty useless when we compare it to an eagle. We cannot spot a mouse from 30 meters above. And our ears are very useless if we are comparing it to a dog. So basically what we are is we are very much disabled, whether we want to know it or not. Mm-hmm. All of us, whether we are blind, sighted, or deaf or hearing. Now, what does it do with us? It doesn't make us sad. It doesn't make us depressed. And in fact, actually, it makes us creative. And this is the whole understanding that I want to bring into society. Disability or limitation is always the mother of invention and creativity.
Now, Paul, I imagine when parents of blind children in the Western world hear about the incredible results you guys have with the children in Tibet, do you have many applications from the West trying to get their kids onto your program?
Per year, we get about 300 plus applications from around the world. We had about 50 countries this year. Most of these countries are from developing countries. Of course, we believe that bigger problems that need to be solved are, of course, concentrated in such countries. However, there's plenty of problems that need to be solved at home as such, you know, like in the developed countries as well. Unfortunately, we don't get too many applications. And we do have a feeling that, you know, one of the reasons is that people in the West, they are more or less in a comfort zone. And yeah, they have a lot of fear to leave that. Mm-hmm. There's the fear for the unknown, what is around the corner, you know, it's kind of the insurance policies. You see that in the West, people have all insurances. People here are not insured at all. So it's to take a risk for a lot of people is very frightening. Then, you know, it becomes difficult to, you know, to be open-minded and to really apply for a program like this. But we do have a few. But of course, hopefully some people, they might understand that this is a great opportunity not only to learn more about themselves, because that's probably the biggest learning that people have here, is that they get to know themselves very well. But that they are exposed to peers from around the world and people that have overcome adversity in incredible forms and shapes. And they're incredibly strong and they have the right solutions, right? So I think that exchange, we always say the most important part in the course here are the most valuable resource are the peers, the other participants, right? The course is of course, it's a very practical, hands-on, experiential learning of how to do things in different ways to make things work. But the, you know, the biggest lessons that we learn and the biggest experiences that we can hear about are from our participants themselves.
And what about Kintari's plans for the future? I hear Africa could be in the pipeline.
We travel to Africa to look into possibilities to start a second campus. But after having done that and having seen the situation, the local, you know, the local political and also geographic, you know, demographic situations, we decided not to do, you know, to start up a second campus. We have the experience of being in two places at once, being Tibet and south of India. And that's as such is already a rather big challenge to focus, you know, really on quality. You need to be 100% in one place. But what we do is, instead of us going out there, Of course, we train people that go out there and make projects in their own places. They speak the language, they know the culture, they know their history. They are part of the target group, right? So it's the power of Kantari lies in the fact that when somebody starts something in their own community, they're talking about we and us, and not about them, and you. And that's something, if somebody in Africa, in East Africa, says, well, we people with albinism should not be killed, that makes a much stronger statement than if somebody from outside comes and says, hey, you should not kill your people with albinism, right? So I think that's something that is important.
Another way, what we want to do is to create springboards. So springboards are basically mini Kantaris, which are run by our Kantari graduates. So they have learned everything they need to know, and now they are going back into their own regions and countries, and they are collecting people that have similar interests like them. For example, there's Ojok or Samuel who are working with disabled people and blind people, and they are collecting people who are from their area and who want to learn in a very, very intense and short, course, in a summary, basically, what is the problem that needs solving. And if they understand that this is something for them, they might then come to us here in India and do the real Kantari as well.
Sabria, if anyone is listening to your interview and is affected by sight loss in any way, what advice would you give to them?
My advice would probably be, don't look at your limitations, but look at the things that you can do. Don't look always at the disability, but look at the possibilities and understand what is the privilege that we have as blind people, as people with so-called imperfections. And I think that is something that is still lacking, that we are always trying to figure out how can we be as good as the sighted. No, we are different, and we don't have to measure ourselves with the sighted. We can stay blind, and we can have the right to be blind without being disabled.
And just finally, if anyone would like to get in touch with Braille Without Borders or the Kantari Institute, how can they do so?
Well, people can contact us via our website. It's www.kantari.org. So that is KANTHARI.org. And there's a contact form there. If people would like to know more, they can use the contact form. If they want to volunteer, they can fill out the volunteer form. Of course, financial contributions are always welcome as well. If people want to support, and they can find the ways how to do this. And of course, the last one, if people want to apply, there's an apply button. I want to become a participant. And of course, we're looking forward for next year or during the year. The applications can come in at any time. We're looking forward for many more people to apply.
Sabria Tenberkin and Paul Cronenberg, thank you very much for talking to us on RNIB Connect Radio.
You're very, very welcome.